Hi there. Welcome to The Circle of Life, Part 2, Episode 4, with Wally Chartrand at the table. In this episode and the one following, Wally tells his personal story. He tells it with authenticity and bravery and clarity, and it includes some strong language that might not be suitable for all audiences, so some listener discretion is advised. Here's Wally.
So we've gotten to, I guess, a general recap from last week. So what I wanted to do with you the rest of today was I wanted to invite you on a little journey to kind of demonstrate what I was talking about being not balanced along that journey. So how I thought I would do that is I thought I would invite you to come on my own personal journey, right? So here goes. So to know me is to know that I came into this world November 28, 1961, at St. Rose Hospital near Dauphin, Manitoba, right in the center of Manitoba, pretty much, right? So I kind of figured right off the bat that this part of my journey, it was pretty good, in the sense in that as soon as I was born, I realized that I had all my fingers, I had all my toes, and everything up here worked the way it was supposed to work. So I kind of assumed that maybe my mother, maybe while she carried me, maybe she didn't abuse alcohol or drugs. But I did notice something missing in the delivery room as soon as I was born. And what I noticed as being missing was my Portuguese dad, right? This man that was supposed to teach me how to ride a bike never taught me that. This man that was supposed to teach me how to catch a ball didn't teach me that. This man that was supposed to pick me up and comfort me when I fell and hurt my knees never did any of that because he wasn't around, right? He disappeared before I was even born. So I didn't realize it here how that would affect me along my journey. But I remember one day in grade 3, we had show and tell. Now, if you remember show and tell, right, we would all go up to the front of the class and we would all bring an object and we would all talk about it, right? But anyways, that day, my teacher, being a creative person that he was, decided instead of bringing something, he said, I'd like for each of you to go to the front of the class and to talk about your dads, right? So I was sitting there thinking, oh, shit, right? Because I didn't know anything about my dad. My mom never talked about him. So I sat there one by one, all my peers, they went up to the front of the class. My best friend, he went up there. My dad's a fireman. He drives a big red truck. He climbs ladders. He puts out fires with a hose. He saves people. This little girl I had a crush on. My dad's a fisherman, drives a bombardier on the ice. He cuts a hole in the ice, puts a net, pulls it out. He catches lots of fish. All one by one, they all went up there. Finally, it was my turn. So I walked up to the front of the class. I turned around, and I looked at all my peers. I looked them all in the eye, and that, these boys, these girls I played with at recess, lunchtime, after school. I looked at all of them in the eyes, and I lied. I made up a story about my dad. I remember sometimes I'd get into a fight with another boy, right? I'd get the upper hand, that boy'd be laying on the ground. He'd jump up, run, turn around halfway. I'm going to get my dad to beat up your dad. I don't care, right? But deep down it hurt, right? It hurt knowing that I didn't have anybody to stand up for me. So early on, around grade 3 or so, I started asking the question, well, why? How come he doesn't want to be a part of my life, right? And it didn't take me long to figure out the answer. In fact, I didn't have to look very far because all I had to do was look over here. Ah, that's why, right? Not white enough. So I thought it was my fault, right? I thought it was my fault why my dad did not want to be a part of my life. So I started carrying that around very early that somehow it was my fault, right? Now, when I was a little boy, I'd look at my mom. My mom, she was very attractive when she was young. She was a beautiful woman, right? Now, the thing about being attractive and single is that she had a lot of male friends. And sometimes she'd bring these men to our home. Sometimes they'd watch the TV, go home. Sometimes some of them would stay the night. I remember many mornings having breakfast. Strange guy having breakfast across the table. A little bit uncomfortable. Sometimes they'd stay a week or two, a month or two. Sometimes some of them even stayed a year or two. Nothing wrong with that either, right? But some of these men that she would bring home, sometimes, especially if my mom wasn't around, they'd look at me, right? You little prick, you little cocksucker, savage, right? Names, right? Sometimes when my mom wasn't around, some of them would give me the backhand, right? Sometimes would give me the boot. I remember this one time we're living in Swan River. My mom, she made supper, and then she left me and this guy having supper. She went off to bingo. So we're sitting there. Now, one of the things about me is I'm always fussy when it comes to food. I've always been fussy when it comes to food. But one of the things I used to be fussy about was that crust around the bread. I don't know why, but I was fussy about it. I didn't like it. So we're sitting at the table and I'm peeling the crust. What are you doing? He asked. I'm going to eat my bread. No, what are you doing? I'm going to eat my bread. No, that's not what I'm asking, he said. What are you doing with that crust there? Oh, I don't like it. Well, listen here, he said. You know what, he said? I work fucking hard to put this fucking food on this fucking table. You're going to eat this fucking crust. And the more I said no, the more upset he became. He got so upset at me that soon enough he was yelling, screaming the top of his lungs, scared the shit out of me. So I jumped up, I ran in the room, closed the door. No sooner did I close the door, he came, kicked the door open, grabbed me by the hair, put a knife to my throat. You're going to eat this fucking crust, right? Big white guy, knife to my throat. I believed him. And from that day forward, any time I would look at my mom, right? And through my eyes, when I'd look at her, I would think, you ugly. You ugly bitch, right? You're supposed to be protecting me. You're only thinking about yourself, right? You're only thinking about yourself, right? So very early I started carrying that around, right? Absent dad because it's my fault, I'm not white enough, right? And now I'm getting hurt by these men because she's not doing her damn job, only thinking about herself. Now the thing about these men is they would leave our community, right, to go and work Ontario, Alberta, wherever, right? And my mom, she'd chase after them sometimes, right? And she would leave me, right? And she would leave me with my cuckoo, my great-grandmother. Right? Now, to know my cuckoo would be to know probably one of the most loving, most caring little old women. Right? That was my cuckoo. Actually, in fact, I used to love it this time of year in the wintertime, right? Because for us, winter is the time of storytelling, right? So every evening, every night, I'd crawl into bed with my cuckoo at her home in Mallard. And my cuckoo, she had this down-filled blanket, goose feathers. Must have weighed about 30 pounds, this blanket, right? Because she'd have to throw it on us, right? So anyways, that blanket would land and I'd be just stuck there beside her. But did I ever feel safe laying beside her. Now, the thing about my cuckoo is my cuckoo, she was a devoted Catholic. That was her faith. Right, she was a very devoted Catholic, and every night, never failed, she would take her rosary and she would say her prayers. Right now, the thing about the rosary, those beads, that's a prayer for each little bead around that rosary. It takes forever, right, to go all the way completely around. Finally, she'd get towards where that little cross was, and I'd get all antsy, right, because I knew she was going to be done soon. Sure enough, she would take her rosary and she'd put it to the side and she'd turn around and she'd start telling me stories. Nenebush, Wesegajak, Windigo. She'd tell me all these stories and that. And I would close my eyes and through her words, I would be like turning on a TV because I knew exactly what Nenebush looked like. I knew where Windigo Khan lived, right? Through her words. Sometimes she'd tell me stories about her childhood. Now, my cuckoo's childhood was very different from mine. She was born in 1897. So her childhood was very different. I remember one story she shared one time. She was maybe about 8, 9 years old. Maybe she was playing along the lake in Mallard, right? And she said, as she was playing along the lake, that she came across these huge bulrushes, tall bulrushes. And as she opened those bulrushes onto the lake, she said, in front of her passed a canoe, she said. about four or five men, she said. They didn't see her, right? They just glided past her along the lake. And they could see her. She could see them, I should say. What she noticed about them is none of them had any shirts on, right? But all of them, she said, none of them, she said, none of them had any hair on the side, just on top, she said. Yeah? Mohawks, Algonquins, right? From up east somewhere, maybe. And yeah? Little old Mallard, right? So those types of stories I grew up with. My cuckoo, she didn't have electricity in her little house in Mallard, right? And every evening we'd sit by the coal oil lamp, right? And how I remember being mesmerized by the flickering of the lights along the wall, right? Now my cuckoo, she was always forever busy. I never saw her sit still in my lifetime with her. She's always busy, always doing something. And at night, her favorite thing was that, you know, she would be knitting. She was always knitting something, right? My cuckoo, she liked to smoke as well. So because her hands would be all busy, right? So she'd always ask me in that. And sure enough, I would take her rolling paper, her tobacco. I got pretty good by the time I was maybe 7 or 8 years old. My favorite part too, after I'd roll up her tobacco, she'd say, "How's the coke?" She'd say, "Light it." So I'd take a match. But that's the kind of relationship me and my cuckoo had, right? So very loving, very caring relationship. I learned a lot. Didn't realize it then until much later, all the things that she had taught me. But anyways, November 28, 1974, I was living in Mallard at my mom's. My cuckoo, she lived next door to us, right? I could see her house right outside her window. And I went to school in Waterham. It's about an 8 mile from where I was living. So we had to take the school bus. But anyways, November 28, 1974, my 13th birthday, sitting in school one day, this girl, she passed me a note, opened the note, "Joyce likes you." Oh, my head just went like that. My heart started pounding. First time. Now, the thing about Joyce is Joyce lived across the lake in Skounen. So I remember coming home on the bus, running into my mom's house, dropping my books, running across the lake to be with Joyce. And all through that December, January, and into February, come home, drop the books, run across the lake. Weekends, get up, run across the lake. And I wouldn't come home till late. But I remember coming home one late February night. My mom, she met me at the door. She said, "Abin, sit down. Kiguchi namo nana, I have something to tell you. Kiguku apajakwazi, your grandma's very sick. Can't throw it down. She has cancer." So that's how I came to find out that my grandmother was very ill with cancer. She went on to say that the doctors had told them that maybe she had maybe about 2 more weeks to live. I don't know how in the hell those doctors knew that, but sure enough, on the 5th day after we found out, my cuckoo, she died. So I was sitting at her funeral in Waterham in the church, just packed in all these beautiful good memories of all the wonderful things that she had given me, that she had done for me, thinking about all those things. And I started to think about the last 3 months. And the more and more I thought about those last 3 months, I could not remember once going next door to go and be with my cuckoo. And all of a sudden, this overwhelming feeling of guilt and shame. Because the one person that had been there for me, and where was I? Across the lake, being selfish. So I remember I started crying and that, and I couldn't handle it, so I jumped up and I ran in the bush, and I cried and I cried and I cried at her funeral. So I started carrying that around when I was 13. Absent dad because it's my fault, right? I'm not white enough. Men hurting me because, you know what, she's only thinking about herself. And then now the shame and guilt because I did have that one person. But where was I, being selfish? I had my first drink a month later. And I drank and I drank and I drank. I quit school when I was 14. I drank and I drugged and I fought and I drank and I drugged and I fought. By the time I was 16, it had become just a part of life, right? To be high and drunk 2 weeks, 3 weeks straight was normal. That was normal. I remember this one Christmas and that. They were living up in Easterville near Grand Rapids. I remember I went next door just before Christmas, next door to my mom's place, started drinking right through Christmas and into the New Year, right after New Year. 11 days later, I finally came home. I remember one can of spaghetti during that 11 days, not even going home once to go and change. So that's how it had become, right? In fact, I used to have this little pot belly. And I used to get proud of that, because I saw all the other men in my community, they too all had little pot bellies. So I thought that's what it meant to be a man, right? In that way, right? I remember this one time I was 16 years old, I got into a fight with this guy. I beat the crap out of him, knocked him out, covered in blood, right? But that wasn't enough. So I started beating up that house where we were partying, ended up cutting my finger. 2 weeks later, I was here in Winnipeg, still partying. Had a big ball on my hand where I had cut it, and these red lines up my arm and that, right? Friend looked at that, he said, that looks awful, convinced me. So he took me to Children's Emergency here at Health Science Center. Walked in, doctor looked at my hand, he said, you know what, you're lucky you came in, he said, because, he said, those red lines, that's gangrene starting to go up your arm, he said. If you would have waited another week or so, we'd probably have to amputate your arm. So I ended up 28 days at the hospital over this little finger. But while at the hospital, I met a social worker, his name was George McGee, and he kind of took a liking to me. Right, every day he'd come and visit me in my room, and you know, just talk and whatever. Right, but anyways, towards the end of the 28 days, one day he came in. He said, "What are you going to do when you get out of here?" I said, "I'll probably head her back home." And by then, he kind of had an idea that that's what I was about. He said, "Is that what you want to go back to?" "I got no choice," I said. "Well, we all have choices," he said. "In fact," he said, "if you'd like," he said, "I could probably arrange a place for you," he said, "if you want to really give it a try." So I said, "Sure, let's try it." So anyways, March 3rd, 1978, he picked me up when I got released at the hospital, drove me out to St. Norbert to this place called Excalais, right? Today it's called St. Norbert Behavioral Management something something. And he walked me in and made me sit in the hallway on this chair, and I waited for the first time in my life, right? Because that's what the sign above me said. After about 3-4 hours, three people came, took me into a room, interviewed me, and after they interviewed me, they told me I could stay. So that's where I ended up for the next little while. But while there, when I was 16 years old, I met this girl from Rosa River, 14 years old, right? While my head went like that, second time. After being there about 19 months, one day I decided, you know what, I had enough of this place, I'm going to take off. She said, "I'll come with you." I said, "Sure, let's go." So we end up headed up north to my mom's place, right? And we became like rabbits, and it didn't take her long, she became pregnant. Our first son, he was born on July 23rd, 1980, over here at Women's Pavilion here in the city. But before I could run that movie about teaching my son how to ride a bike or catch a ball or picking him up when he fell and hurt his knees to comfort him, in walked Children's Aid of Eastern Manitoba. "You're not fit. You abuse alcohol, you abuse drugs, you're violent, you don't have a home, you don't have a job. We're taking your son." And that's exactly what they did. They took our son from us. And not too long after, he became a permanent ward of Children's Aid of Eastern Manitoba. To make a long story short, we readopted him when he was 4 years old. But that incident at the hospital, it scared us, right? So we ran further north. And again, we became like rabbits, and again, she became pregnant. Our second son, he was born on February 3rd, 1982, at Guy Hill Hospital. Yeah? 1 minute after my son was born, I carried him in my arms. His hair was all wet. He had all his fingers and he had all his toes. And I made a promise to my son when I promised him that, you know what, I'm going to teach you how to ride a bike. I'm going to teach you how to catch a ball. I'm going to be there for you when you fall and hurt yourself. That's what I'm going to do, my boy. 10 short months later, December that same year, we were commercial fishing on Lake Winnipegosis. I remember we're at this fish camp. I remember getting up that morning around the middle of December, me and my little boy wrestling in bed, him blowing on my belly. I remember getting up, putting on my ski suit, my boots and everything. I remember hugging him up when just before I walked out the door, told him I'd see him when I got home. I remember I was out on the lake all day that day and that day, fishing, commercial fishing. I remember coming home around 5, 6 o'clock that evening. It was pitch dark outside already. I remember the lights were out where we were staying. I remember opening the door, walking in, turning on the light. I remember there was a note at the table, picking it up, baby sick, gone to hospital. I remember I ran next door to go and use the phone because I didn't have a phone. I remember that nurse at the other end telling me, yes, your son is very sick. He's so sick that as we're speaking, he's being medevaced to Winnipeg. We suggest you get down there. So I remember I got on number 6 and I started hitchhiking because I didn't have a car. I remember this Gardewine trucker picking me up. I remember he dropped me off 5 o'clock that morning right outside Children's Hospital. I remember I walked up to the third floor ICU intensive care. I remember walking in this little glass bed, wires, machines, tubes all over my little boy. I remember that doctor, he took us aside that day to tell us that our son was very sick, that he was so sick that his heart had stopped twice on the plane ride from DePauw. But he also told us that because his heart had stopped, that our son didn't get oxygen into his brain. So the doctor told us that they believed that our son was brain dead. And he said also when they tried to revive him, they had also punctured both of his lungs. So that's why they were also having to breathe for him. So here's what we know so far, he said. Here's what we know so far. We know that your son is brain dead, meaning that he's probably never going to wake up again. He will never wake up again. Now here's what we don't know, he said, about anybody when they're in that vegetative state, he said, that coma state, he said. What we don't know for sure, he said, is if they can feel any pain. And that's probably one of the worst fucking things you can tell a parent, right? Because no parent ever wants to hear that their child might be in pain. 3 or 4 days later, that doctor, he took us into a little room, told us that we had two choices. He said, you can leave your son, he said. We're not pressuring you. We can leave your son, he said, on those machines, he said. But you need to know, he said, that your son will never wake up, he said. He's never going to wake up again. He may last another week, another month, another year, maybe even 10 years or longer, he said. But we know he'll never wake up, he said. Or you put some papers in front of us, or you can sign over here and we will take him off. So that's what we ended up doing. We ended up signing those papers because we didn't want our son to be in pain. 7-8 hours after we signed those papers, I was carrying my little boy in my arms, just all nice and warm. And that movie in my head about teaching him to ride a bike, catch a ball, picking him up when he fell and hurt his knees to comfort him, died that day because my son was dead. And I thought, who in the fuck is this God, right? What kind of loving fucking God would do that to me? There's no such thing as fucking God. No such thing as God, right? So I started carrying that around when I was 20 years old, right? Because I had this beautiful dream and God had taken it. Absent dad because it's my fault, right? Min hurting me because she's not doing her damn job, only thinking about herself. I did have that one person, but where was I being selfish across the lake? And now this beautiful dream, but God took it. God took it. So I had all this anger, because God took my beautiful dream. But life had to go on. Now this girl I met when I was 16, did I ever love that girl, right? You know that saying, you can look but don't touch? Well, you know what? I didn't even have to look, because everything I wanted was right there. About 5 years into that relationship, I was working for NADAB, Drug and Alcohol Services out in Rosa River, south of Winnipeg here. I got sent to training in Gimli, just north of the city here, right, for a week. Came home Friday, my partner, she met me at the door. She had a strange look on her face. So sure enough, she said, can you sit down? I have something to tell you. I said, okay. She said, while you were gone, she said, this week, she said, I started drinking, she said. Okay. But that's not all either, she said. While I was drinking, she said, I also cheated on you. Ah, it just tore my heart, right? Just hurt my heart to hear those words. But I still had all that love. Okay, I'll forgive you. I can forgive you. Several months later, I was gone to training somewhere else again. Came home Friday. She met me at the door. She had that look again. Sure enough, I drank again. Sure enough, I cheated again. Same guy even, right? Oh, shit. Just hurt the hell out of me again. But I still had all that love. Okay, I can forgive you. Let's fix it. Let's fix it this time, right? So what we ended up doing is we ended up moving to Winnipeg. Pretty smart, I thought, right? Problem is in Roseau. Move to Winnipeg, no more problems. Smart, I thought, right? About 8 years into that relationship, I was sitting at the Pine Creek Inn, or the Westbrook, I should say, here in Winnipeg, with a friend of mine. These two girls came over to our table from Pine Creek First Nation, asked if they could join. We said, sure, started buying drinks. Woke up the next morning at the Gordon Downtowner thinking, ah, shit, now I had done the same thing. And this overwhelming feeling of guilt, because now I had done the same thing. Now, the only difference for me was I could not find my guts, right? So I went home pretending nothing happened. Some months later, I was at the bar again. Different girls came over. Woke up the next morning. Oh, shit, did it again. But what I noticed that next time was the guilt wasn't as much. So I did it again and again and again and again. Till one day, absolutely no guilt, right? No guilt whatsoever. In fact, that movie in my head, I was thinking, you know what, I have it pretty good. I have this woman in Roseau looking after her home, looking after the kids. She cooks all my meals. She does all my laundry. And over here, I get to sleep with all these different women. Pretty good, I thought. 14 years into that relationship, we were living up in Thompson by then. I went to a conference in Banff, Alberta. Came home Friday. She met me at the door. She said, I had enough. Enough of your drinking, enough of your drugging, whatever else you're doing. She said, I had enough. I'm taking the kids, I'm moving back to Winnipeg. 2 weeks later, that's exactly what she did. She took everything, all the kids. I was left with a little bed, my dresser, my little bit of clothes, empty, totally took everything. Sitting in this three-bedroom house, the longer I sat, empty house, soon those walls, they began to creep on me. So I had to fix that. So I'd run across the road to the Thompson Inn, TI. And I'd be there on a Friday night, Saturday night, just packed, hundreds of people, whatever. Everybody dancing, having a good old time. And me feeling so, so alone. Oh, that's a god-awful feeling, right? To believe that nobody cares about you, that nobody loves you in this world. Oh, I would not wish that feeling on anybody. But that's how I felt. And more I felt that, the more resentful I became, because the thought then was, well, who is she to give up, right? She did the same thing. Did I give up? No, I didn't give up. But as soon as I did that, she gives up right away, right? So I started carrying around when I was about 30. Absent dad because it's my fault. I'm not white enough. Men hurting me because, you know what, she's not doing her damn job, only thinking about herself. And I did have that one person, but where was I? Being selfish. And I had that beautiful dream, but God took that dream from me. And now this resentment, because from where I sat, I didn't give up, but she gave up on us.